Hello and welcome to the Fun Kids Bookworms podcast. My name is Bex and I love books, and I'm especially happy this week because we're celebrating World Book Day. So we're going to hear from some of my favourite authors that we've had on the show, as well as hear some ideas of what you might be getting dressed up as on the big day. So to kick things off, let's hear from Carrie Hope Fletcher. I spoke to her last year all about the Double Trouble Society and the Worst Curse. The sequel to the Double Trouble Society. Yes. You brought us a brand new like adventure with your gang. If we haven't had a chance to read the first one, where do we find Ivy and Maggie?
Okay, so Maggie and Ivy are two best friends who happen to be born on the same day, at the same minute, of the same year, and they are best friends and they live one house apart, but the house in between theirs is this sort of old, dilapidated house that's been abandoned for years. And then all of a sudden, this very mysterious stranger turns up, and there's a legend within the town that they live in called Crowwood Peak, and it's the legend of the Crowwood Witch, because 300 years ago, there was a witch who had sold her soul in order to continue her reign of terror forever. And the only way that that pact that she had made would come true is if she ate the hearts of 13 children.
It's a tall order.
And she only manages to capture 12 children and is stopped by her sister by the time she gets to the 13th. So she never claims that 13th child. So the legend is that she will one day return 300 years later to capture that 13th child. So when this mysterious stranger turns up at this house, Maggie and Ivy are certain that it's the Crowwood Witch come to claim the 13th child. So that's the first book. That's the Double Trouble Society.
Excellent summary. Love it. Yeah.
I know. Very cheerful. Great. And then the Double Trouble Society and the Worst Curse, which is the sequel. We find Maggie and Ivy again. This time, there are three new kids at school called Spencer Sparrow, Harriet Harper, and Orville Thomas. But they might not be who they say they are. And it's all about Maggie and Ivy discovering who these kids are and maybe what they are.
Yes, because as they join school, as all people do when they join new schools, are a bit nervous.
Yep.
Which means they are acting a little bit suspiciously, a little bit
Absolutely.
Weird.
Absolutely. It could just be normal nerves, but it could be something else.
Yeah, now I don't want to, this is the problem, Carrie. I don't want to ruin too much for people who haven't read the book yet. So I'm trying to figure out what to say without spoiling too much of the book.
Yes.
Basically, we've got the Double Trouble Society.
Yes.
And they know that in the place they are in Crowwood Peak, there's a little magic around.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a possibility.
Extraordinary things can happen.
Yes.
And they know this. The supernatural is well within their wheelhouse. They know that this is a complete possibility, as do pretty much everyone in the town. It's not just the kids. All the adults are pretty savvy to it now as well. They're suspicious in all the right ways.
They don't think
it's first day nerves. But also we've got to deal with the fact that I don't want to spoil anything from the first book, but we are carrying on the story from the first book because there is someone who is very angry about something that happens at the end of the first book who is coming back to seek revenge.
And now I have to say also, you've got some absolutely beautiful illustrations.
Oh, they're so beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah, they're, I mean, incredible. They really bring it to life. I mean, not that the words don't do it justice, but like, it's really exciting to like turn the page and you've got some absolutely brilliant characters all drawn there for you as well. Did you get to see them before they were in the book?
I did, yes. But the guy who does them, Davide Ortiz, he's just incredible, and he's never ever shown me an illustration where I've gone, maybe that could be changed. It's always like perfect and spot on, and his style just suits the book
so perfectly. Yeah,
and I love that he really buys into the story and really, you know, has a look through, you know reads the book and really understands what the chapter headings need to be, because it's not just the front of the book and the back of the book. There are illustrations the whole way through at the beginning of every chapter, and they all perfectly encapsulate what the story is.
Yeah, they're absolutely magical as well. And with the characters, I feel like they're your gang now. They're your pals.
Yeah.
Do you want to see them back again? Are you thinking perhaps we're going
to... I would love it. I would love to see the gang back again. There's nothing in the pipeline as of yet, but if we ask Puffin nicely.
I mean, I feel like there's a strong possibility, Carrie.
Fingers crossed.
I reckon we can do it.
But no, I love the gang so much, and I would love to continue their adventures.
Carrie, thank you so much for telling us all about the book.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love talking about this book. Thank you for giving me a chance to.
Always, not a problem. And it's out in all bookshops right now, I imagine.
Right now, yes. In all good bookshops, you can walk in and purchase your copies of both of them right now.
Perfect stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Oh, big thank you to Carrie Hope Fletcher for coming into the Fun Kids studio. That was such a fun day. Next up, we've got a big, big author. Everybody knows him. Everybody loves him. It's David Walliams. Now, this is what happened when we spoke about his book, Space Boy. Yeah, you bring us lovely Ruth, who's had a bit of a tricky time. She's living with somebody she's not a big fan of, I'll put it politely. And she suddenly has a bit of an adventure. It gets exciting.
Well, I want it to be exciting. I want it to be a real page turner. You know, I write these books because I want kids to just read them for their own pleasure. The good thing about this is that once the alien has crash landed on Earth, which happens actually in the first chapter, the whole thing has got this momentum, you know, because they're trying to escape the whole time from the police, from Secret Service agents, all those kind of people. And there's also a kind of big secret as a part of the book. So it's how long they can keep this secret going for as well.
One of my favourite bits, this isn't a spoiler, is when they're on their bum sliding through a crater. So have you tried any of the activities that Ruth and gang did in the book?
Well, I really want to go into space, but I haven't done that yet. So that would be my sort of dream. I think it could be really exciting. I've always been obsessed with science fiction since I was a kid, and I still love it now. So there's that. Have I tried anything like that? Well, I love sliding down. I've never stood down a crater, but I love going down a icy hill on a bin bag. I love that kind of stuff.
Now, we have also a lovely little dog in your book, Yuri. Was that inspired by one of your dogs, perhaps? Apart from, of course, the missing leg.
I do, yeah. My dogs have both got four legs each. I'm often thinking about things in my life and how I can incorporate them into my books. And so, yeah, the behaviour of Yuri is a little bit, I don't know, he probably does a bit more than a real dog would ever do. But he is hopefully as lovable as my dog. So, yeah. I tried to get some of their personality, some of their sort of playful personality in there.
Now, I also mentioned, obviously, I've read the book, and a lot of your books have been turned into films and TV shows. In my head, if I was to cast it, I'm putting you as Dr. Shock.
Well, the villains are the best parts, always. They're the really fun parts, aren't they? You know, like Ralph Fiennes in Harry Potter as Voldemort. You know, I mean, amazing, isn't he? I mean, he's just a great, great actor, really. Is the thing you remember probably more than anything in Harry Potter is that is him, because he's just, once you've seen him, you're gonna have nightmares about him for the rest of your life. I'd love to play a villain. I played Bert in Rat Burger, which we adapted for Sky TV, and I love doing that. It was just so much fun. And so, yeah, I would love to do that. I'd love there to be a movie of this. Who knows? It certainly would be a very expensive movie. Because it's about space travel. That's the problem, because people go, well, we'd like to make a movie, one of your books, but we don't want to have to spend $200 million doing it. So maybe one day.
Yeah, I was reading it thinking, oh, he's going to be ambitious if he's putting this on TV, but you never know. Somebody out there.
Yeah, I know. I think it would be very tricky to be on TV, because you've got the night, you know, on this kind of budget that you would have on TV, because it's like 1960s America. So that's hardly going to get all the cars and houses and clothes and everything right. And then you've got like UFOs and rockets and underground secret bases and helicopters and super planes and all this kind of stuff. So the great thing when you're writing is, because I used to write, when I started, I was just writing for television. And then you'd always be told, well, this is too expensive. You can't have a crowd of 100 people. You can only have two and all this kind of stuff. And it was often a bit frustrating, because you'd have these ideas, you know, of a sketch that could happen at Wembley Stadium, you know, with the England football team. And they go, that's not going to happen. You're never going to be able to film that. But luckily, when you're writing a book, that's not a problem. If you want to be in Wembley Stadium with the England football team, you can.
David, thank you so much for chatting to us. And thank you for telling us about Space Boy.
Thank you very much for that. That was wonderful.
Tell you what, another one of my favourite authors that we've had on the podcast, somebody who I think everybody basically worships, is the author of Warhorse and Kensuke's Kingdom, Michael Morpurgo. This is what happened when I spoke to him about When Fish Flew and the astounding stories behind it. This is a very exciting one. When Fishes Flew is a story of Eleanor's War, and it's the first novel in, is it 2 years that you've had out?
Yes, it's the first novel for some time, but I've been writing other things as well. But this is the first novel, yeah. And I'm very excited about it, because it is, I think it is, you maybe could do some research for me, Bex, or your listeners can.
I'll try.
But I think it's the first novel ever to be written and told by a fish.
I'll have to do the research on that one, but I'm going to probably take your word for it, let's face it. You know more than I do.
I think we are close to it being the only one ever told by a fish, and I'll have to explain to you what's behind that. really. Shall I tell you what the story, how the story started? Is that the best thing to do, Max?
Go for it. Yes, please. Please do.
Because it involves a fish, as you might guess now. And all the stories I write, all of them, begin with some rather fortunate happening, some place I visit, someone I meet, some story I hear. In this particular case, 2 years ago, before the pandemic, if you can believe there was a before the pandemic, Claire, my wife, and I, we were in a place called Ithaca, an island near Kefalonia and Corfu in Greece. Why were we there? Because we'd become interested in the Odyssey, great book by a fairly decent writer called Homer. And Homer had lived on this island several thousand years ago. The ruins of his house are still there on this island. And we knew we were going to stay on the island, which is part of the great legend of Troy. And we happened, by pure coincidence, to be staying in a little house on a beach called Dexa Beach. And this was the beach up which Odysseus walked several thousand years before in legend when he came back to see his wife after 10 years being away. And there was this old lady and a whole family, about 15 of them. But there was a grand old lady who was clearly the grandmother of the whole thing, dressed in a long black dress. And she would wander up and down the beach each evening about 5 o'clock, picking up any bits of plastic or bits of wood that had been washed up by the sea, which we thought was wonderful. She was looking after the beach. Anyway, one day we were lying there watching her do this again, watching the family play in the sea, jumping off the quay and all this. And then suddenly she looked at us and beckoned us over. Come, come, come. So we went over and she was holding something cupped in her hands like this. And it was a flying fish. She said, they come here to die, which was very sad. And then she looked at us and she looked at us very, very straight. And she said, and they talk, you know. She started stroking the top of the fish's head very gently. And the fish made this sound. The fish was talking. And I'm not lying. This really happened. The fish was talking. And I didn't know fish talk. I knew whales sang in the sea, but a whale is not a fish. This was a fish talking.
And it must have been, you seem to do a lot of research as well. So it must have been nice to have the time to kind of to research the history of the kind of the Greek gods and the geography of the area, but also the war and that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, and what was lovely is I was already reading this book, which was full of Greek gods and Greek heroes. So it was pre-done, all that. And the place I've been to Ithaca, I knew every beach and I knew every rock, and I'd been to Homer's house and I'd asked him, you know, we got sort of really involved in the whole life of the island and the legend. But I did have to do some research about the occupation by the Germans and the Italians of those islands during the Second World War and the resistance fighters who died trying to get them to go away and go back home. And then the awful things that happened once they got rid of the invaders, which they did, and then the British, our soldiers, arrived and helped them rebuild a bit. And then at last they had their freedom. That was really wonderful for them. And then along comes an earthquake in 1954 and kills many, many, many people. And then you had to research that again. And you found out that there were a lot of people who were helping other people. Some people had to leave the island. So all that had to happen. And then that was done. And you'd think that would be enough for the island. But no, no, no. They had a really unpleasant fascist dictatorship that came in Greece and threatened the liberty of the people again, told them what they could and they couldn't paint and write. And she was part of the resistance for that as well. And then you'd think that would be the end. But what has happened just recently, of course, is that war has come to their shores in the shape of refugees, which it has actually to all of Europe. But the Greeks are on the front line of it. They're coming up from Africa, across from Turkey, the first shores they come to in Europe, which is where they're longing to come to for safety and security, is Greece. And they're coming there in their tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. And so it's another kind of an invasion. And they held out their hand to these people. It was very, very difficult because there became too many of them. And then what happens and what happens? And wherever there's war, there are refugees. We know that in this country. And our country is full of people who came here during the First World War, during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And all through history, you know, we've we know this at first hand, and the Greeks have gone through that. And so they're all on this little island. All these things happen to these people on this little island, and sort of microcosm, if you like, of the way the world was during that century. So I find it interesting to follow one girl and one woman's journey through this and what she did and what so many of them did do, which was to be enormously courageous right the way through it and spend their time just helping other people, which is what we have witnessed hugely during this pandemic. We know it's in all of us to play that part, you know, and it's heartwarming to see it, even when there's it's a world of tragedy around us.
Well, Michael Morpurgo, thank you so much for chatting to us for Fun Kids. I've had a blast. I'm sure our listeners will do as well. So thank you so much, and we'll look out for all of your many books on the bookshelves.
Great. Bless your heart. Thank you, Bex, very much.
Now, I know lots and lots of people will be dressing up as characters from their favourite books for World Book Day, so I recently spoke to Claire Balding to find out if she had any ideas of inspiration for us.
Well, there's a really, really great illustration of Dravid the Draco Lizard, and he's in his running kit, but he's a lizard, and he's got little wings under his arms, and that looks really cool. But I think the idea of any animal, so an elephant, for example, in Lycra running gear is funny. It's just funny. So you sort of have to have two costumes, the elephant and the lycra. So no one's parents are going to thank me for that. But yeah, there's lots of great animals that you could. Maud the Sloth looks really cool in running kit as well. I get a lot of messages around World Book Day from children dressing up as my heroine in the racehorse books that I wrote. It's called Charlie Bass. And lots of people put on jumpers and like riding gear and they go as Charlie. So that's quite fun.
All right, then, let's keep this World Book Day podcast on the move. Next up, we're going to speak to one of my actual heroes and probably my favourite author ever. Sorry, everybody else. It's the author of the Tracy Beaker series and loads of other books beside, Jacqueline Wilson. Now, this is what happened when we spoke to her about her reworking of an Enid Blyton classic, The Magic Faraway Tree. Now, can you tell us what is going on here?
Well, my book is The Magic Faraway Tree, A New Adventure. And I haven't rewritten the three wonderful Faraway Tree books. What I have done is I am done a follow-up so that I have got my own modern children and they go to what seems to be a holiday cottage, but is the exact same cottage that is used in the book where Enid Blyton's three children live. And I've had such fun because I've been allowed to have my modern children discover the enchanted wood, go up the faraway tree, meet my very favourite characters. I love this book as a child. Silky the Fairy, Moonface, the Saucepan Man, Dame Washalot, all those lovely characters. And then when they go up the ladder at the top, poke their heads through the clouds, you see a different land practically every time you go up there. But I haven't copied Enid Blyton's lands because they were wonderful. I don't want to change them at all. I've invented my own lands. I've got the land of unicorn. I've got the land of dragons, land of bouncy castles, land of princes and princesses. All the things that when I was young, I would have liked these lands as well. So it's been a treat for me right from the beginning.
Mind you, the bouncy castle land was my favourite. I read that and thought, oh, I want to go on a bouncy castle. I was so jealous of the characters. Now, you said it was one of your favourite books. Now, does that mean it's a bit overwhelming to kind of write in that world, or were you really excited to do it?
I was thrilled to bits to be asked, but also my stomach gave a bit of a lurch and thought, so many people loved these books when they were young. So many children read these books now. Do you really know what you're doing? But I thought, I just want to show modern children just what a wonderful magic world it is and carry on. And I very much hoped that Enid Blyton, if she were still alive, would say, okay, you know, you take over for a bit, Jacqueline. I've done my stint. I've done over 600 books. Come on, you're just a beginner compared with me. But give it a go.
And you bring in such lovely characters as well. You've got this lovely family who are on holiday in the cottage, and you've got Milo, Mia, and lovely little birdie as well. It must have been quite lovely to bring brand new characters of your own making into this world.
I very much wanted there to be children that readers could identify with and find interesting. And I wanted them really to behave as I thought modern children would. I mean, Milo and Mia at first are a little bit sniffy about the very idea of there being a fairy, for instance, and they might indulge Birdie, their little sister, but, you know, they roll their eyes at the very idea. And so it's again fun when I confront them with Silky the fairy, who was my childhood heroine. I adore Silky the fairy. I wanted to be Silky the fairy, or I wanted to have her as my best friend.
Yeah, of course.
And she's just slightly changed in that she's my concept of Silky, but I know that Enid Blyton and all the people that adore her books would feel that, yes, she's Silky, and Moonphase is still the same, because I think these characters were really unique characters in that they had their own quirks and ability to make magic sweets and they're endearing these silly at times, like Saucepan Man. I mean, I had fun. There's a character in the books, a minor character called Dame Washalot.
Yes, I was going to say, yeah.
And I thought, poor old Dame Washalot, does she really want to be washing all day long? So I've given her a best friend called Dame Iron All Day. And then they can have fun together and they can go up and bounce around on the bouncy castles. I thought, let's liberate the dames. I'm a dame too,
of
actually.
Course. Well, of course, you've got to all stick together. Jacqueline Wilson, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Oh, it's been great.
Thank you so much to Jacqueline Wilson for that. Next up is Alison Hammond, who joined us to chat about her book that's all about the secret history of the UK in Black in Time, the most awesome Black Britons from yesterday to today. I love this book so much. I love a history book. And Alison was awesome.
I have read your book, Black in Time, and I think it's brilliant. I loved it.
I'm so glad you've read it. And yeah, it's just a really enjoyable book. It's the sort of book that you can nip in, nip out. You don't have to read it all in one. You can come back to it. You can absorb one of the amazing Black figures in it and just like go, wow, they were incredible. It's historical. It's people you might have heard of. Some of them you might never have heard of. And it's just a lovely collection of wonderful people who have done incredible things.
Honestly, you tapped into my little, I've got a little history bug inside me and you tapped into it really well.
Oh, you know what? It's so good that you said that, Bex, because that's exactly what I wanted from this book. There's still amazing people in history that we don't know about. So if I've tapped into somebody's like bug for finding out more, that would be absolutely incredible. And that's what I want. I want kids to go out and do their own investigations. Obviously, I concentrated on Black people, like, but there's Asian people, there's people of lots of different ethnicities here in Britain who were part of our history that we probably don't know about. So if I can ignite something in children or in adults, that would be great. I think it is that also that book that adults are going to love as well. It's not just for kids.
Yeah, because as you say in the book, I mean, I didn't study a lot of these people at school. You know, we study the Romans and the Tudors for, it feels like, about 10 years. And, you know, some of the people you mentioned, I was like, I've never heard, like Septimus, the emperor and stuff. So I didn't know about this man. This is amazing.
I mean, I didn't know about Septimius Severus, and he was a major part. He was an emperor. He led from the front. You know, he fought in battles. He loved his soldiers, and he was a Black guy. And I was like, wow, this is incredible. Who is he? Where's he from? And it was just so interesting to hear about these people. Like, you can remember like learning about Henry VIII, but I didn't know he had a Black trumpeter in his course. Yes. You know what I mean? I didn't know this. I was like, wow, who is this man? And then you go on to find out that John Blang was the guy who went to Henry VIII, bearing in mind that Henry VIII was the guy who used to chop people's heads off, even his wives. And like, he went up to him and he said, listen, you're not giving me fair pay. I want a little bit more. I want it to be the same as everybody else. I want fair pay. And then he actually got that from the king. Do you know what I mean? So there's these incredible people pioneering, you know, forward thinking, not afraid to stand up for what was right. And I believe it's important that I stand up for these guys who are not around anymore, and bring them to the forefront and for our kids to look at. And it's nice to get a different perspective on history.
Actually, the trumpeter was another person I read and made a little note of, because I was like, this is amazing. Like, Henry VIII bought him the wedding clothes as a present and stuff like that. It's like, that's...
Yeah, well, he's obviously really liked by Henry VIII, you know what I mean? And yeah, he was an integral part. And I think he was a really good trumpeter as well, to the point where he even helped and taught Henry VIII a few little moves on the trumpets and stuff like that, taught him how to use a trumpet. So, yeah, and if you go back in history, if you dig even deeper, you can find pictures of him as well. But there's so many different figures in time. I mean, Mary Seacole, a lot of people have heard about her.
Yeah, I did know Mary Seacole, yeah.
And I remember learning about Mary Seacole from my mom, actually, because my mom said that I was very kind and caring like Mary Seacole. So I was like, oh, who is this Mary Seacole? Who is she? And it turns out she was a very vibrant, loud, vivacious, you know, the soldiers absolutely loved her because she was absolutely hilarious, but she was very kind as well. And her sort of medicine was very much from the land. She used to grow herbs and spices and stuff like that to heal people. So yeah, she was a lovely woman. And my mum said I reminded her of Mary Seacole. So she's in the book, which is lovely. But also what's lovely as well is not only have I got these characters who are no longer here anymore, there are people from here and now who are movers and shakers and are doing incredible things now.
Thank you so much for chatting to us about your new book, A Black in Time. It is brilliant.
And thank you for reading it. And I'll try and get you a copy in the post because you deserve it.
You do. I'd love it so much. Thanks.
Our last and but no means least author on this World Book Day special bumper edition of the podcast is Dermot O'Leary. Now, this is what happened when we spoke all about Wings of Glory and why it's perfect for both history and animal lovers.
So if the listeners don't know, we've gone from cats to birds. You love an animal. And this is Wings of Glory, which let's go back to it then. Is it historically accurate, Dermot? How much of this have you researched properly?
No. During the Second World War, what a lot of people don't know is that the animals were fighting on our behalf, and with some notable exceptions. And we had a prime minister. So whilst Winston Churchill was in charge, the animal prime minister was Sir Bertie Bulldog. Yep. And Bertie Bulldog signed an official secrets act. They didn't want any records to be disclosed up until now about Linus the Swift and Linus's incredible actions during the Battle of Britain when he signed up for the Royal Bird Force. So the story is, true story, that Linus the Bird and his sister, Linus the Swift and his sister Ava, were born in Kent, and then they migrated down to sub-Saharan Africa. And then during the war, the call went out for all birds of a flying age, and especially speedsters, and the Swift is one of the speediest birds there is, to come back and fight on the front line to harass the German enemy planes coming over by any means necessary. But basically, the mantra of the Royal Bird Force was, in poo we trust. So the idea is they have to use their poo as much as they can on the enemy windshields, on the planes. The planes then get distracted, and then the actual human RAF can come and mop up after all their hard work. So Linus signs up for the to be in the Royal Bird Force. But when he gets here, he's desperate. He wants to fight on the front line because he's a Swift and they're the fastest birds, but equally fast are the Peregrine Falcons. And so he wants to fight in the squadron of Peregrine Falcons, but they won't have him because he's not a kind of blue blood, because the Peregrines are very much considered the proper flying boys and girls. So Linus ends up in a squadron with a magpie who steals everything, an owl who won't get out of bed before 8 in the evening. So he ends up in this raggle-taggle squadron, but somehow he ends up being pivotal to world history.
Well, should we just stop the interview there? Should we just done and done?
I do feel like I've actually just told you probably a bit too much.
No, I love it. No, that was such a cracking summary of the book, because we meet Linus the Swift, him and his sister Ava. They go off to the UK to try and fight for country and king and country. And Linus is so excited. And also, like you say, he's a very quick bird, right? And at first, people don't take him seriously.
Yeah, he's almost too quick. And also, he's very young and is very raw. And all he wants to do is come over and fly with the Peregrine Falcons. And of course, he isn't a peregrine, and so he can't do what they do, but also they can't do what he does. So I love that about it. Like, I love my birds. I've always been a sort of keen bird watcher. And my best friend Joe, my oldest friend Joe, he got me into birds when I was about 11, and I've always loved them ever since. So writing for the books about Toto was wonderful, and I love the fact to create a world where the animals have got their own transport system, yeah, and government and police and all those sort of things. It's so interesting, and actually sort of that's what was cool, almost my starting point, because I haven't finished my Toto books, but I thought, well, what else do I want to write about? And I love history, and the Second World War is sort of my favorite part of history. But maybe I don't quite know why I like the idea of ordinary people put in extraordinary circumstance, and I love the idea of it's quite recent history. So for me, my grandparents' generation would have been part of it. For a lot of your listeners, it would be the great grandparents' generation. But my father grew up in Ireland, but in the 40s, so he grew up being aware of what was going on in the Second World War. So it's not that long ago, is my point. And it's kind of recent history and these incredible stories, that you can read about that humans kind of, this kind of normal everyday people suddenly put in life-changing circumstance. I find that absolutely fascinating. And we always ask the question, what would I have done?
Mm.
And then I thought, well, I really enjoy writing for kids and through the prism and the personification of it, like animals. So hang on, why don't I do that? Why don't I take my love of history and combine the two? So it's kind of, there will be actually echoes in the books coming forward. There'll be echoes of kind of the people that went before Toto who worked for the government.
Brilliant, Dermot. Well, thank you so much for chatting to us.
Thank you. My absolute pleasure.
Well, what a lineup we've had in this World Book Day special. Carrie Hope Fletcher, David Walliams, Michael Morbergo, Claire Balding, Jacqueline Wilson, Alison Hammond, and Dermot O'Leary. Don't say we don't spoil you. That is it for this week's Fun Kids Bookworms World Book Day special. Remember, you can hear me chatting to loads of amazing authors all through the year, every other Wednesday, and we've got some wicked authors still to come. So make sure you like, subscribe, and follow wherever it is you get your podcast from. See you soon. Bye.